He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
No! Bad lawyer! I need a loophole!
He's not Judge Judy, an executioner!
He is!
Sorry, but my mother always said if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
Will that hold up in court?
No, I've tried it before.
Stop. Ask a question a lawyer would ask, please.
I am a lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 398. We are closing in on 400. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Yeah, I'll bet you are. I'll bet you're doing fantastic. You're on a nice trip. I'm insanely jealous. I don't want to out you, but I think your sound is going to be a bit different. People know something's up, and it sounds lovely, and I wish I were there.
Little family trip to the beach. I thought I'll take a week off. I thought, what's the worst that could possibly happen? I thought, what could possibly go on in the news that could, you know, prevent me from enjoying, you know, a week's relaxation, you know, with my family, socially distant, away from everyone else, at a nice beach. Yeah.
In retrospect, like, let's say we get out of this in 2020 or whatever. That's funny. I said in 2020 because we'd said that for 4 years, right? Like waiting for the next election. But in November, I suppose. And it'll be interesting to look back and say, what was the least eventful week of that 4 years? Yeah, I know there was some in there, you know, like. But like because I was going to make the joke, like, you can't take a vacation, you dummy. Like, there's no.
Yeah.
What, have you not been paying attention for the last 4 years? There's no week that's going to not have a thing happen. And then I was thinking, I remember a time, wasn't there like a brief like month or two when people, and it might have been 2018 or 20. Remember that time? There was a time when people were like, you know, Trump is kind of, you know, he's kind of normalized a little bit. I think he's turned a corner. Remember that? It was like a month that he was slightly less insane for like 1 month, and nothing. I think there wasn't a whole lot that happened. I'm going to track that down someday. Historians from the future listening to this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That was the one time you were allowed to take a vacation then and no other time, Andrew.
Well, as it turns out, it's a working vacation. So here we are, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I love doing the show.
All right. I'm excited. I also am excited for our first segment, which is just a pre-segment that Andrew has typed in. And I don't think we need to clown horn.
No,
this.
No.
I pull up the notes for the show. The first thing I see is, why is there a dipshit card going around saying you're exempt from mask rules? And that's when you know Andrew is having none of it. Because Andrew, I will put the question to you, sir. Why is there a dipshit card going around saying you're exempt from mask rules?
The way it was sent to me over Twitter and in the Facebook group and directly emailed to us. And I mean, you know, like a dozen of you have sort of asked about this, but the way it was put on Twitter, I thought was better than I could put it, which was, this is what happens when arts and crafts Karens have too much time on their hands.
But also it's like, it's always an old white guy,
yeah,
who thinks they have like a better understanding of the Constitution than everybody.
Yeah. No, this is sovereign citizen level logic.
Yeah.
So this is the FTB agency, right? Which, and their logo is a little like stylized eagle with some red lines coming out of it and some stars around it. Because, you know, eagles and stars go together, right? Because, you know, the flag. You will notice it redirects to FTBagency.com. not .gov, that yeah. FTBAgency.com, I think, has already been shut down. And it's this like little laminated card you're supposed to pay them that has misspellings and typos on it. And it's just stupid. The claim is, right, under the Americans with Disability Act, I am not required to disclose my condition, which is the condition being I don't want to wear a face mask because I'm an evil bastard and I don't care that I infect people, which, by the way, not a recognizable medical condition. And, you know, and it says, you know, carry this around and show this to people and, you know, that'll shut them up. The serious question that I have received, and I'm sorry to put people in this position, is, right, I represent small businesses that serve the public. And so in addition to kind of general curiosity, I've gotten, hey, like, what do I do if somebody comes into my store with one of these things? And the answer is whatever you would do ordinarily to eject someone from your store, right? I given where we are, I can't say call the cops because that may not be a great option for you. If that has been a good option for you in the past, call the cops. Whatever it is that you do to enforce your rules, this card is nonsense. A cursory look at it reveals it to be nonsense. It's not how the ADA works. Possesses is spelled with more than just the P-O-S-S-E-S. You know, like, it is nonsense. It is dangerous nonsense. It is ridden with spelling errors, grammar errors, punctuation errors. A cursory examination shows that to be so. And I am sorry that the burden has to fall on business owners to tell crazy people coming to their door, no, you can't come in. But you should absolutely feel comfortable enforcing whatever rules you have on your shop, regardless of whether one of these lunatics comes in with one of their little, you know, hand laminated cards. It's crazy. You're not going to subject yourself to any ADA violations as a result of it.
So I know this is still, I guess, a pre-segment, so it's not meant to be a deep dive. But one wonders about if there's any, you know, any kernel of truth in any of this. I absolutely do not know, but there could be medical reasons why someone can't wear a mask. I could imagine that, certainly. Is that something? What would happen in that case?
So here's there are a couple of things that overlap there, right? The first is that the ADA requires certain businesses that serve the public to make reasonable accommodations to admit those with disabilities, right? And the classic example of that is you got to put in a ramp, right? It's not hard to put in a ramp, put in a damn ramp. But there are two important components to that that are elided over by this card. Right? The first is that, and previous versions used to say, like, under HIPAA, I'm not required to, you know, which is also just a grotesque misuse of that law. Nothing in the ADA says you get to have a secret medical condition and then seek accommodation, right? So you have to disclose what it is that you have that is preventing you from entering a place of public accommodation. And then number two, they have to make a reasonable effort to accommodate you, right? But they don't have to make every effort to accommodate you. And if reasonable efforts to accommodate you are insufficient, right? That there are cases, right? Like, you could easily come up with edge cases in which, you know, someone in a wheelchair is unable to use, you know, a standard wheelchair ramp, right? Like, that doesn't mean that business has to go and, like, install an elevator and a crane and everything, right? Like, it's that the case law is very, very clear. It's designed to open up, and it's a great law. Again, an example of what used to be bipartisan laws in this country, right? This was passed in the early 1990s under Republican President George H.W. Bush, and extended by Democratic presidents, and, you know, with bipartisan support in the Senate, you know, something that would never happen today. And the idea was, hey, maybe we should make our public squares more reflective of who we are as a people and a population. And it really does kind of sicken me to see, like, sovereign citizen wackos distorting what is an excellent law for, you know, for that purpose. So yeah, if you were particularly sensitive to certain kinds of face coverings, I know there is there are a wide variety of different face coverings, right? Some that conform to your face more tightly, some that have the kind of like, you know, riot guard plastic shield that comes down. Like that, there's the idea that, you know, I don't know that we could even find in this country an edge case of like the one person who can't wear any kind of facial covering, you know, and also can't arrange to have like their groceries picked up on the corner or something.
Right.
Like that, right. Like it's, you just, you don't have, I mean, for the same reason that like there isn't a constitutional right to challenge the like 7-Elevens, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Right. Like,
right.
Because yeah, nobody can force you to wear a shirt, but you don't have a constitutional right to go into a 7-Eleven either. So, you know, it's just crazy.
I thought that was, the 7th through 11th Amendment that guaranteed me. I will say this eagle's looking pretty good, though.
Yeah.
I pulled it up just to see for reference.
Gosh.
It's a sharp eagle. America, baby. I don't have to wear a mask. I don't have to prevent you and your grandma from dying. America. All right. Let's get to the actual show. Down. 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 I just saw, this is, again, more fresh news that Andrew has to rapid respond to. This is so fresh that I have no idea how to pronounce this.
I think it's Thurisigium, but
Thurisigium.
But I did not listen to oral arguments, so I don't know.
So this one of the, like, dinosaur periods that is suing? There's the Jurisigium period and there's the Triassigium. I assume this has to do with dinosaurs, one way or the other. Is it dinosaurs want asylum and we're saying no? Finally, about time.
No, not quite. This was, and I want to make a linkage here that nobody in the press so far is really making.
The dinosaur one? Finally, we did it. We blew the lid off that
dinosaur one. Yeah. This was a Sri Lankan national. His name was Vijayakumar Thurisigium, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, and I apologize. And he fled Sri Lanka and crossed the southern border, so from Mexico into the United States. So I guess, you know, flight from Sri Lanka to Mexico. The details of how he got to the south are not explained. Crossed the border and was stopped within 25 yards of the border by a Border Patrol agent and was detained for expedited removal. And what Thurisigium was claiming was that he was going to petition for asylum because he had a credible fear of returning to Sri Lanka because he had once been abducted off the street and assaulted and severely beaten. And the reason for that is his Tamil ethnicity and political views. And I need to profess a profound ignorance of the Tamil conflict in Sri Lanka.
Finally, I've been waiting for you to do that for these past 4 years.
Well,
it feels nice.
But you know, so I can't really speak to that conflict. What I can do is talk about how this interacts with our existing immigration laws and the pernicious connection that nobody else has made. How this interacts with what Trump wants to do, which is empower DHS to round up people en masse at the border and hold them indefinitely in camps or deport them back to their home countries without any semblance of due process. And this case is a 2017 case, right? It's all the way at the Supreme Court. These things take years to get up there. So this case predates the Trump administration's changing of the rules just about 1 year ago today, but absolutely interacts with it in a way that is going to be terrifying and frightening if Donald Trump is reelected. So put a pin in that as I explain kind of what happens under Thurisigium's case, because let me cut to kind of the spoiler here. This is a 7-2 opinion.
I saw that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about that.
It's a little bit of an odd alignment. And in particular, right, you have the 5-justice conservative majority that signs on to the opinion. You have a concurrence concurring in the judgment for this case only that was written by Breyer and signed by Ginsburg. And then you have a really odd Sotomayor-Kagan dissent. And I say odd, not because it is not a well-reasoned dissent. It is, and we'll talk about it. But because on the court's left wing, Kagan has probably been the furthest right of all of the liberal justices. And you don't typically see, right, Elena Kagan staking a place to the left of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm going to explain why that is and how that came about in a minute, actually. So this particular case is probably defensible as a holding in and of itself, right? We're going to talk about it. It turns on a unique particular question. The problem is the way the immigration laws are currently written and the deference and discretion that they give to the executive branch. So let's talk about that now. Here's the way immigration law works in broad strokes. And I would say we talked about this extensively in episodes 301 and 314. But basically, there is a procedure called expedited removal. And expedited removal is exactly what it sounds like. It means that INS agents can round you up and deport you back over the border without due process, without you getting to speak to an immigration judge, without you getting any kind of legal remedy whatsoever. And it was intended to apply for when the border guard, right, sees you run across the border, right? That's the typical understanding of expedited review, right? And again, we can talk about this in terms of, you know, the initial policy, right? But I get the idea of, okay, I just watched you cross the border, right? I shouldn't have to go into a court of law and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you've crossed the border, right? I get to shine the lights on you. And if you decide to run in, you know, further into the United States, I can pick you up and take you back across the border without due process, right? That initial notion of expedited removal got expanded in the 90s to include expedited removal for non-citizens who are arrested within 100 miles of the border and unable to prove that they have been in the United States for more than 2 weeks. Okay. And that, look, that's a terrible thing. It should not, like, it clearly, we can crack the argument for, yeah, why don't you turn around right now? But then expanding that out to 100 miles and 2 weeks, it's a harder argument for me. A year ago, just about a year ago today, the Trump administration expanded that to anywhere in the United States for up to 2 years after you have arrived, okay? Which is, which is obviously preposterous, right? It is not an appropriate extension of the rule. And if that application goes through, it is currently being litigated, it will not take effect. It has been enjoined. And so will not take effect, will not be litigated on the merits until after the 2020 election. But here's what that means. It would mean that anybody anywhere in the United States who cannot prove that they have been in the United States for more than 2 years can be summarily deported without any chance at due process whatsoever. right?
I don't even know if I can prove it.
Yeah, seriously, that's really, really hard to do. And it's especially hard to do when you're talking about folks who are already at the margins of society, right? Yeah.
Does this also imply that Border Patrol then also gets to be anywhere in the country?
Indeed it does. It would expand their jurisdiction. And again, you know, it would be that the same kind of logic of like, well, you know, why the, you know, the fact that somebody was able to travel 105 miles away, I mean, you know,
counterpoint though, armed men wandering around asking people for their papers is always worked out in history.
It is. Look, that is the logical consequence of what these people want. So that's how these two cases interact. Let's talk about Thurisigium's case, okay? Because his case is not under the new Trump rules, right? This was a 2017. These are the old rules. But it has to do with what you can do when you are caught up in one of these expedited removal raids, right?
Okay. Procedural question.
Yes.
And sorry,
I don't want
to throw you off.
No.
Why wasn't this a case of, oh, they've adopted new rules, so then that obviates the case happening or whatever, you know, like, why didn't the new rules kind of, doesn't that sometimes happen when there's a case pending under the old rules and then you make new rules and then so that means the old case is kind of thrown out because it's not, I don't know what the legal term.
No.
Why not that?
So good question. And there are really two answers to that, right? The first is the new rules have been enjoined, so they have not yet gone into effect. And the second is they are adjacent, but much broader than this case, right? This case presents sort of the unique question of, I am caught up in an expedited removal raid. What rights do I have? And one of the rights that you have, even under expedited removal, is to petition for asylum, right? And again, the reason why you petition for asylum is I live in great fear that if returned to my home country will murder me. And the United States has always been a nation that has held as its ideals that we will not return people who come from oppressive regimes to those oppressive regimes to be murdered. Again.
Yeah. I feel like as an American, that would be the minimum we can.
I also think
we should just allow anyone who wants to seek asylum because their country is otherwise dangerous or whatever. I mean, I would want to draw that line much further out.
That
should be a minimum.
You would, and it goes beyond the scope of this episode to point out that then Attorney General Jeff Sessions drafted guidance from the top down for DOJ that interpreted asylum incredibly narrowly, particularly in cases of countries that had lax or hostile laws regarding spousal abuse and treatment of women, right? So in other words, that the Sessions memo greatly curtailed some women who fled from abusive households and said, look, like, it's not so much that I'm here on political asylum. I'm here because I'm fleeing a country, and it's not hard to envision many of these countries in which the law has said, we will not do anything if, you know, your husband, kills you for an honor killing or beats you within an inch of your life. And under the Obama era rules, those women were granted asylum. Under Trump, those women are being denied asylum. We could do a whole nother show on that, but yes, at the same time, I mean, remember, this is a coordinated multi-front effort. And as part of that effort, the Trump administration has been curtailing the definition of who qualifies for asylum and on what grounds. But the important thing is when you are swept up in an expedited removal raid, you have the right to then say, I am requesting asylum. And when you say, I am requesting asylum. That triggers a tiny bit of due process. And here is the due process that that triggers. It triggers, for the first time, an asylum officer has to determine whether your fear of persecution in your home country is, quote, credible or not. Okay. And that is, there are guidelines as to whether a fear is credible, but that's the way that it works. And then if the asylum officer says, no, you have the right to then appeal to their supervisor. And if the supervisor says no, you have the right to go to an immigration judge. Okay. And we have talked about how all of the reasons why we laid these out in episode 301 in particular, all of the reason why immigration judges are not a great process, right? They have quotas. I mean, we referred to a Washington Post article from a former immigration judge that detailed all the perverse incentives for immigration judges to rule against immigrants. But that's at least something. It's different than being rounded up, you know, thrown in a truck and shipped out. So you at least get that minimal level of something, right? Somebody other than the guy with the gun and the body armor dragging you back across the border. So this case is about, after you've exhausted those approaches, can you file a petition for habeas corpus, right? Can you say, I am being illegally detained by the United States government in that they are picking me up and summarily deporting me back across the border without due process of law? And the statute says that you can claim federal habeas corpus, right, only in three unique circumstances, okay? And crucially, those three circumstances are very, very narrow and do not include, right, that there was a mistake of fact or law, right? So it is right. Section 1252E2, and it says you get to petition for habeas corpus, one, to review whether you are in fact an alien. Okay. So in other words, you're actually a U.S. citizen. You don't have your documentation. You're swept up in one of these raids. You fail to persuade the INS officer, his supervisor, and an immigration judge. You can still petition for habeas corpus because you're a citizen. Okay. Second, whether you were ordered removed, right? And again, that's a basic rule of law question, right? That is, the immigration judge says, no, you should be allowed to seek asylum. The border guard hauls you back across the border anyway. You get to file for habeas corpus in that case. And third, whether you have already been granted entry as a lawful permanent resident, refugee, or asylee. Right. So I guess that's really kind of a subset of number one, right? So if you have a pre-existing right to be here, or if the INS officer has gone rogue, you can file a habeas petition. But you cannot, and explicitly it says, there shall be no review of whether the alien is actually inadmissible or entitled to any relief from renewal, right? And that is everything else that you would say that you would think might come into play with traditional habeas corpus, right? Yeah, you guys have screwed up. I really am a political dissident. There's a death warrant out for my arrest, you know, in Mexico if you send me back across the border, and I will be shot and killed. And I can prove that. The law says that's not good enough. And that was what was challenged in this case, right? So Thurisigium said, yeah, I get it. I don't fall into one of these three narrow categories. But I should, because we have the right for persons in this country to petition for habeas corpus. It is called the suspension clause in the United States Constitution. And you may not suspend my right of habeas corpus as a person present in the United States. That's the issue that was before the court. And that's the issue that has produced kind of the odd alignment, right? And again, not a super odd alignment, but the real question is, as a historical matter, right, understanding the suspension clause, quote, as it existed in 1789, so we're back to originalism. The question is, does habeas corpus apply to somebody who is seeking asylum in this country? Right, that's the simplest way to phrase the question. And I have to tell you, right, as I read both the majority opinion and the Sotomayor dissent, I think that people of goodwill could come out on both sides of that issue, right? There seems to be, look, I am obviously more persuaded by the dissent. I am more philosophically and politically attracted to the dissent. But this is what got Justice Breyer and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to sign on to a very narrow concurrence, which is to say, is that limitation on the right of habeas corpus unconstitutional as applied to this particular party in the circumstances of this case? And so what then the seven justices constituting the majority have said is, as a matter of historical basis, right, the difficult questions about the scope of the suspension clause, right, do not compel that they apply to these kinds of claims brought in this kind of case, right? That is, somebody seeking release and then seeking an additional right on top of that, right? And again, I would almost certainly come out the other way, but I can't tell you that in isolation that decision is irrational. I think it's very clearly to me, like the breakdown is you have Breyer and Ginsburg are analyzing this as if it were still 1985, right? And as if you still had a functioning, you know, the Supreme Court's never been non-political, but a functioning Supreme Court that was not staffed with right-wing lackeys eager to, you know, facilitate a monstrous right-wing government. And you can see in the Sotomayor-Kagan dissent a deep skepticism about what this administration in particular is going to do with these particular rules.
So is this just a question of, like, we obviously need to fix this the way we need to fix a lot of things, which is just replace our president? It's one of those things where it's like, okay, it would be nice, I guess, if the court could kind of do all this for us, but it's one of those cases where it maybe doesn't make sense and we really just need to have better rules at the get-go rather than this additional ability to, like, petition.
Look, I think you could have both, right? So there are several different potential outcomes that we could go through here, right? The first would be an expansive view of habeas corpus that applies to everybody in this country the second you set foot on U.S. soil, right? That's not a preposterous thing to say, right?
Oh. And all right, well, we can do that. Yep. Would that fix the whole, like, if you're on death row and you have evidence that you're innocent, is that related to that too?
You'd
get a habeas or not.
Well, the question is, what would the ground, the death row actual innocence cases are not about? I mean, they have the right to bring the habeas petition. The question is just, what do they need to show in order to grant habeas relief?
So this is more about who can even bring the habeas.
That's exactly right. This is about what can you do as we are hurtling towards a society in which INS is going to be directed to and has been, but you know, to expand rounding folks up without any semblance of due process. And this was one of the, you know, keys that was sort of in the back pocket, right? Like, okay, yeah, great. You gave me, I petitioned the guy who hauled me across the border and he said, I'm going to, you know, haul you back across the border. And his supervisor said, that's fine. And, you know, one of these immigration judges said, you know, we find no credible evidence that, you know, that you have a risk of imminent violence upon being deported. So, you know, too bad. And a habeas petition was sort of a last ditch effort to say, no, this really is bad. And the result of this decision is it's gone.
Like, let's say this decision went the other way, hypothetically. Mm-hmm. Who then would Thurigesian have been, like, if he had done this petition, then would the same potential a-hole or non-caring immigration judge who was going to throw him out in the first place, would they just review it again? Nope. And be like, still no.
No. That's what he wanted to do. When you file a habeas petition, that gets to be reviewed by a federal court, by a U.S. district court. Okay. Right. So yeah, with all of the attendant rights of due process that attach to that. And so the real question here is what this case has done is made it easier for the government to move to dismiss in those kinds of cases, right? To say, hey, you only get to petition for habeas corpus for those three things that we talked about, right? Are you a U.S. citizen? Are you an approved admittee under some other provision? Or, you know, did the border agent go rogue? And unless you allege one of those three things, this court doesn't have jurisdiction to consider this petition. That's the result of this decision. Mm. And again, in isolation, I don't know that this would rise to a high level. You know, you would just come back and say, look, if you want to extend these rights out, then, you know, amend the law, right? You're like the law doesn't have to say habeas is only available in these particular cases, right? The law could say, everybody gets the right to file a habeas petition.
Oh,
right?
I thought this was like a constitutional interpretation. So there's a law that can...
So it's both. The question is that law, that's the 1252E2, is that law constitutional? Does that comport with the suspension clause? Or is that an unconstitutional restriction of an individual's right to petition for habeas corpus? Does that make sense? I can... kind of
it's almost like you got to be a lawyer. Let me expand
that out just a little bit.
I think I get it.
Yeah, here's the way to understand that. Suppose Congress passed a law tomorrow that said if you've been convicted of a crime, you don't get to file a habeas corpus petition, right? You would then
sounds unconstitutional. Yeah,
of course, that would be unconstitutional. You would file a lawsuit under the suspension clause, and you would say that law is unconstitutional because I have rights under the Constitution to petition for habeas corpus, whether or not the Republicans in Congress like it, right? And mm-hmm. you can't take that away from me by passing this law. So the question was this other law, which again, it's a different kind of restriction on the right to petition for habeas corpus, the one that says if you are swept up in a border crossing and you are targeted for expedited removal, you may only file a habeas petition if it meets one of these three criteria. The question was, is reducing your habeas right a permissible restriction under the Constitution? And the court said yes.
Hmm. Okay.
So yeah, the court could have gone the other way.
One of those things where it's like, if you reduced it past some hypothetical point, then it would no longer
it is possible that this ruling leaves that open. It's tough to imagine where the contours of that would be, right? Like it's when you read the majority opinion, right? It's the kind of habeas rights that they thought that non-citizens enjoyed in 1789. But there is hypothetical daylight there. But I want to emphasize the other side, right? Which is that you could either change the law and or you could change the executive branch policy on how people are swept up for expedited review. one is going to be considerably more challenging than the other. But look, one of the things that I'm pushing for that I think we will use our platform here on OA in a Biden administration is to aggressively re-engage with the legislative branch, right? To make actual laws so that we don't have this situation of, you know, the incoming administration undoing everything the previous administration does, being incentivized to, you know, politicize all of the executive branches as much as possible, to then cram in as many non-reviewable orders as you can in your 4 years before you get kicked out, right? Like that's no way to run a government. But yeah, so you could, right? So this says the constitutional floor mandated by the suspension clause permits 1252E2. It doesn't require that you restrict it in that way, and you could certainly legislatively expand it and or change the way in which these policies are enforced, which, again, I imagine an incoming administration certainly would do. So there you have it.
Well, okay. I want to make sure you got through everything you wanted because I was interrupting a little early on, but why is this on the path? I mean, you were setting, did you clear that up? Like this is on the path for like something worse later?
Yep, or because what is coming down the pike is the substantive review of the new Trump rules.
I see.
That expand expedited gotcha. Review nationwide and 2 years. I think that there is a good chance that could lose on the merits. It could lose on the merits either narrowly procedurally, which is probably what would get Roberts's vote, right? Because that rule was crammed through without the usual notice and comment. I mean, you know, it's exactly like, you know, the decision we discussed
really
last week.
It does feel like Roberts is going to do everything he can to not rule on merits of things and have a technical way out unless Trump gets another 4 years and then it's all over after that. That seems to be the impression I've gotten from the last two breakdowns you've done.
I think that's obviously correct.
Okay. Yeah. So I think this means we need to vote for Biden.
That would be a first
I'm hearing of it, but okay. I guess I'll vote for Biden.
That would be a permissible interpretation of events. Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for that breakdown, Andrew. I have struggled as a blossoming lawyer myself. I've struggled with the concept of habeas and what, but so sorry, it's a tough topic for me in my law career, but thanks for walking me through that. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Podium. Folks, these days, business owners are busier than ever. Having one place to manage all your communication with your customers isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. Podium is a messaging tool for local business. Bring all your channels into one streamlined inbox. Texting, Facebook Messenger, website chat, payment requests, feedback surveys, and online reviews. There are so many different platforms these days. If you have a business, trying to manage all the different ways that you might potentially interact with customers is vital, and Podium helps you do that so much easier. Convert more leads by taking online conversations offline. You can let people text your business so you can answer questions, schedule appointments, or confirm inventory. Yeah, people want to be able to text your business, especially speaking as a millennial. I love to be able to text a business and just ask a quick question. Don't have any of the pressure of the phone call and all that. That is something you need to be doing to be competing in today's business world. And it's going to make your customers happy. 90% of customers are like me. Wow. Normally, that's not true of things. I'm normally not in the 90%, I don't think. But in this case, I am. 90% of customers want to be able to text a business, but only half of businesses even have that capability. This will allow you to respond faster to customer questions and also keep customer communication in a shared inbox so everyone on your team is always up to speed. This is going to save you time. It's going to make your communication channels more efficient. It's going to make you reach customers faster. And by the way, you can also use it to collect payments. Podium Payments allows you to collect those payments remotely, reducing outstanding bills. So join the 45,000 businesses that rely on Podium to communicate with their customers. Go to podium.com/OA to get started and save 10% off your monthly subscription. Texting isn't just the better way to get more reviews, it's the better way to do business. That's 10% off using podium.com/OA. So next is our main segment that we're going to start 40-ish minutes into the show, which is this ruling in the Flynn case. I know that the OA community is very disappointed about this one. So does this mean our amicus is done or no?
So our amicus is not done, and we will fight on, and I am about to explain what happened. So for those of you who may have seen the headlines or otherwise are aware, in what is an absolute shock to me, right? Like, look, we run, Andrew was wrong. I'm wrong all the time. I did not think I could be wrong on this one. But the DC Circuit, that panel opinion, was a 2-1 decision, by Naomi Rao, which I expected. I just expected Rao to be in the minority, that persuaded Karen Henderson, a George H.W. Bush appointee and moderate Republican for almost all of her tenure on the D.C. Circuit. She has aligned with Rao on a couple of cases, so it's kind of weird. Naomi Rao is a Trump-supporting, flag-waving, you know.
I think I remember you or somebody saying this was like a really good draw for the Trump in terms of the panel.
What I thought was, so the 3-judge panel was Rao, who has voted to rubber stamp everything Trump has done, regardless of how indefensible it is. Henderson, kind of moderate Republican, and Wilkins, Bill Clinton appointee, right? So, you know, a decidedly, right, the center of gravity of that is probably, you know, center right. And whenever you come in to get a panel and you've got to win the other two judges, that's an uphill climb. I thought, I watched the oral argument on this. I thought Judge Henderson was obviously skeptical of the government's position. And she voted with Rao anyway. Let me cut to the punchline before I describe how awful this opinion is. And I want to thank OA social media, our followers, our listeners, because I immediately was sort of struck by the question of, well, who can do what now, right? Because remember that this is a motion to dismiss filed by the government, and then a habeas petition filed by Michael Flynn to require Judge Sullivan of the District Court of the District of Columbia to grant the government's motion, in which the D.C. Circuit then ordered Judge Sullivan to write his own brief, for which he hired counsel to do that. And the question is, well, Judge Sullivan isn't a party to this case, right? Like, can he lodge an appeal or a motion for reconsideration? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know that anybody knows. But here's the real answer, and it may have happened even by the time this goes to press. So I immediately turned to the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, and Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 35 says any party may petition for en banc reconsideration by the entire circuit court, right?
Yeah, which that was going to be the next thing that I was hoping for, because I've learned over the years, you get the panel and then you could go en banc.
Right. And so the question was, great, any party can, right? But is Sullivan a party? I don't know.
Well, so then who would be the party? Oh, would it just be Flynn and like Barr?
Right. Flynn and the DOJ.
Oh, man.
But
that's rough.
The DC Circuit rules in the appendix provide for, and I have multiple cases of evidence.
Yeah. Technicality.
Yeah. Allow any judge on the circuit sua sponte, that is, of their own motion, to move for, to request reconsideration. And because there are 11 judges on the circuit, that requires 6 votes, right? Majority of the circuit has to vote for reconsideration. So I am very, very confident. Again, I've been I've been confident before, but I am very confident that Judge Wilkins is going to move for reconsideration en banc, sua sponte, and I suspect that they will have the 6 votes on the D.C. Circuit for reconsideration to overturn this decision. The grounds for rehearing a case en banc is that either A, the panel decision conflicts with the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, or the court to which the petition is addressed, and consideration is therefore necessary to secure and maintain uniformity, or, and this would be, I think, the grounds on which Judge Wilkins would petition, the proceeding involves one or more questions of exceptional importance, each of which must be concisely stated. For example, petition may assert that a proceeding presents a question of exceptional importance if it involves an issue on which the panel decision conflicts with authoritative decisions of other United States courts of appeals that have addressed the issue. Huh. And so
that's interesting. So there's not a category that's just, this was a terrible decision.
Yeah. Well, it has to not just be terrible, right? It has to be terrible and of exceptional importance. Fortunately, I think this opinion qualifies. And the reason that I think this opinion qualifies is because it somehow manages to get wrong every aspect of the law in a way that is, it's kind of stupefying when you look at it, right? So it gets wrong the underlying law interpreting Rule 48A that we have discussed at great length and that features prominently in our petition. And that is, what is the case of In Re Fokker Services? That's the 2016 case that was about deferred prosecution agreements that we talked about some on the show and features prominently in our brief. Also had a whole bunch of dicta, right? It was not a Rule 48A case. It had a whole bunch of dicta that basically said, you know, there's not that much for courts to do in 48A cases. And I have argued, I think, very persuasively, again, with help from Morgan and Rich, who did a lot of work here, I have argued that Fokker, when properly understood, that dicta is not how the D.C. Circuit would have come out if that were a 48A case and not a deferred prosecution agreement case, right? So that's sort of the one area. Judge Rao's opinion, inexplicably, and again, I don't use these words lightly. I know I'm the guy, like I get loud and yelly and what, like it says that Fokker is not dicta, right? It says, right, that
we all know Fokker is dicta. Lawyers.
You hear me struggling for words here, but this is something that every first year law student knows, right? Like it's a comment. It's not a particularly, you know, it's a paragraph's worth of analogistic commentary in Fokker that was not a 48A case. And as Judge Wilkins says in dissent, like anything that's not necessary to the hearing is dicta. And he doesn't quite say this, but you can read it between the lines. It's kind of embarrassing that I have to tell a sitting judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit this. But here's this page 13. I'm going to read you what Naomi Rao says word for word so that you know that I'm not just mischaracterizing her. Second, the dissent undermines our recent decision in Fokker Services by recasting its necessary and well-considered reasoning as dicta. In that case, we relied on settled constitutional understandings to determine that Rule 48A's leave of court requirement confers no new power in the courts to scrutinize and countermand the prosecution's exercise of its traditional authority over charging and enforcement decisions. That's just flat out false. That quotation from Fokker is itself dicta, and saying how dare you call this dicta is just I'm sort of at a loss for words, and you can see the dissent kind of struggling with finding ways of saying, you know, I can't believe I've lost to this. So it's wrong on the law. In addition to that, it is manifestly wrong procedurally, right? Because remember, what we have here is not an appeal. Judge Sullivan did not, refuse to dismiss the case, right? Judge Sullivan just said, I'm not going to grant this right away. I want to conduct some more fact-finding first. I want to hear from Amicus. I want to figure out if this is a good idea. I would like to maybe hold a hearing, right? Which is what we encouraged him to do in our Amicus brief. And then the government didn't petition for mandamus, right? The government said, fine. Michael Flynn moved for mandamus, right, from the D.C. Circuit to tell Judge Sullivan that he must grant the government's motion. I'm going to try, but it is difficult for me to tell you all the ways in which this screws up the law of mandamus. You don't just, there's a reason why petitions, why what we typically cover on the show are appeals and not petitions for mandamus, right? Because the law is super duper clear. You don't get to petition for mandamus as a substitute for an appeal. If you can only get mandamus if you have no other remedy available to you. And here, Flynn has a remedy available to him, right? He hasn't been sentenced. He's not being held in pretrial detention, right? He's a free man. All the question is does the court get to wait and consider information before considering whether to grant the government's request, right? And so if we were here on a direct appeal, might even be a little different, right? So I thought at minimum, the D.C. Circuit would say, yeah, look, we're not going to grant you mandamus, but we're skeptical. And if Judge Sullivan refuses to dismiss the case, then, you know, we'll address questions directed to the merits when we're here on a direct appeal. Okay. That was as far as I thought it might go if we lost this case at the D.C. Circuit, right? Because that would be kind of reasonable. It's preposterous to award mandamus relief where a party has the right to appeal if they lose. It's just like if you wrote this on a bar exam essay, you would not pass the bar.
I don't even think I know enough to write that wrong of an answer. Well, we're way too late in the show for a broader discussion about what's going on here. But I worry that, like, is this what we're in for since Trump has gotten to appoint 9,000 judges to every circuit federal BS thing? They're just going to. So I wonder what will happen to the law eventually. Like, it will just be there's so many bad decisions on things like this that then become precedent that there's how will we know what's what?
I worry about that, too. Right. That what you have is you have so many people like Justin Walker who have been appointed to reach outcomes rather than to apply the law. And that's where the rule of law breaks down. Right. Because, look, Naomi Rao does not want to expand the court's mandamus powers. Right. Like, that's not a thing that Republicans want from a procedural perspective. She just doesn't care if she expands the court's mandamus powers in order to protect what Trump is doing here. Right. That it is truly everything the right has said about judicial activism dating back to the 1970s is coming to fruition here. You have judges who do not care about the law. They only care about the outcome. I got to give 30 seconds on the other, you know, flabbergasting element of this, which is you don't get mandamus. Right. Mandamus. Right. That's the same root for mandatory. We have discussed this many, 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 many times on the show. You are only entitled to a writ of mandamus where there is no discretion in the government activity that you are seeking to mandamus. Right. That is, it must be a case where there was no discretion and the court or the agency or the government official use discretion anyway. Let me give you a real good example of that. The whistleblower statute, right? The whistleblower statute says after 10 days, the ICIG must turn over any complaint to the House of Representatives, right? Must gives you no discretion. And so when the acting ICIG fails to turn that over in 10 days, that's a case we didn't have to here, but that's a case in which you could go to the courts and get a writ of mandamus and go, look, like, mandamus that guy. Like, it's mandatory. He's got to do it. There's no discretion.
Is that like a seize him? Yeah.
Mandamus that man. But if there is any
That's
discretion.
That's what the paint team will say,
right.
by the way.
Yeah, man.
Drive the van.
That'll be the logo beneath, right, in quotes. Mandamus that man.
To serve and mandamus or something.
But if there's any. But the converse of that is also true. If the official has any discretion, you may not seek mandamus. And let's give a perfect example of that, right? People have asked, could we go to court and force Mitch McConnell to bring X to a vote, right? And the answer to that is always, no, you can't do that, right? Mm. Mitch McConnell has discretion to set the Senate calendar. And even when he's being super abusive and even when it sucks and it's terrible, if an official has discretion in how to do their job, you can't mandamus that man. This opinion, mandamus is
not a man. He's a he's a turtle.
Yes, he's so half man, half turtle, but
doesn't apply.
But that's right. Like, so the other component, and I could go there are other ways in which this is a preposterous abuse of both the procedural and the substantive law. But to get those two basics of mandamus law wrong is embarrassing. And I suspect that even if the DC Circuit did not care about justice in the individual case of the Michael Flynn case, that they care about not having this egregiously wrong opinion on the books. So I suspect that Judge Wilkins will sua sponte move for reconsideration en banc. I suspect that will get granted, will be overturned. And when I said that we will fight on, we will take our amicus brief and submit that brief in the DC Circuit in the petition for reconsideration. Going to require some work to change it up, but we're looking forward to doing that work. And we will bring our analysis, and our argument is going to be the same one that we raised at the district court. For the District of Columbia, and that is that everybody so far is misreading what this court did in Folker, and that reconsideration en banc before the guy who wrote the Folker case, right, Judge Srinivasan, right? Like, maybe if we're all going to think about like what Folker services means, maybe we'd like to have the guy who wrote it be a part of that consideration. Right. And that's going to be our argument. Right. Hey, again, modest. Right. This court should grant reconsideration en banc to correct its dangerously wrong misstatement of the law of mandamus, and also to avail itself of the input of the judge who wrote Folker Services, who can tell us what that language in Folker Services means, or at least who can weigh in.
Well, I'll get working on my new amicus brief.
Yeah, yours has got to be polished up a little bit too, but we'll do both. Yeah. It'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, speaking of normies, you're going to get to hear my amicus brief.
Oh,
I guess.
Yeah.
Announcement time?
Let's do that announcement.
Okay. Well, maybe that'll help salve the wound or whatever that word is. Because, yeah, we're going to release for the Tuesday normie show. We're going to release that Lot Awful Amicus episode where I gave my amicus, and then, well, I won't spoil it, but we kind of reach a decision as to which one we're going to go with. Again, no spoilers, but you'll see, you'll listen. And then also we talk about the process of the real amicus it was a lot of fun. And that's going to be the Tuesday show this week. For patrons, you're going to get a little bonus extra stuff because you've already heard that. So we want to make sure you get something new. So you'll get some bonus discussion. Don't worry. We always take care of our patrons.
Absolutely.
Well, I got excited about that announcement, but I want to make sure you've had your say on this horrible.
I have had my say. It was demoralizing. It's been a rough week, despite being on vacation. But we will fight on. This is not over. And I guess I want to say this. Like, I don't. This is not about making General Flynn do time, right?
You know, I was going to say that same thing. Like, on one hand, because we've said this before, the best case scenario for people who want justice for Flynn is like he gets a couple months or nothing, right? I mean, it's going to be barely anything, but it's become a symbol of do well-connected friends of Trump, by the way, always white men, get to do whatever they want and break the law and have no consequences? Or could there be the slightest bit of consequences?
That's exactly right.
This fight is, you know, people like Andrew and me with my amicus in my own way trying to get there to be consequences for well-connected, well-off white men who break the law as much as they want. And what blows my mind about this decision that you've just broken down is for the end result to be something so minuscule, like, you know, a couple, if anything, couple months, whatever it's going to be, almost no punishment for this guy, for conservatives to say, we're going to put a bunch of bad precedent and change the law in ways that, like, if they had their way and this became like the new, you know, way that this is interpreted, it would be ridiculous, right? I mean, and they're willing to just overturn all that and like have these weird precedents in the system just to protect this one guy from the nothing punishment that he might get. Do I have anything wrong there?
You not only do you have nothing wrong, but it you've said it better than I could, right? Like I had a little bit of a discussion back and forth with a friend of the show, Randall Eliason, about a Glenn Kirshner piece that says, you know, hey, look, the silver lining in all this is that, you know, we could still charge Flynn with, you know, quote, all the crimes, end of quote, in January of 2021. And I disagreed with that statement, right? And Randall and I sort of went back and forth over
which
part? Well, I was going to say I disagreed with both with what I'm going to call both parts of that, right? So first, the scope of what potential charges could be brought against Michael Flynn. Randall is, and I will defer to his expertise as he's a former prosecutor and I am not, Randall is of the belief that charges related to the FARA violations, right, and the failure to disclose the fact that he was lobbying on behalf of Turkey along with Bijan Khan, that you could bring those because that was part of the plea deal. And now there's no plea, but not in the criminal information itself. And therefore, you know, are blown up. We don't have time for me to say where I would, I think there's an argument to be made that those are included by reference from, I think it's paragraph 11. But suffice it to say, where Randall and I were in agreement is that's not like that. To me, that's not a silver lining to say we could later charge Flynn with other crimes, right? Like, you know, yeah, I mean, sure. Like he's, you know, he seems like he's a bad dude who, you know, lobbied on behalf of a foreign power whose interests are often adverse to our own, without disclosing that he was doing that for, like, I mean, some of the stuff was, you know, truly, you know, scumbaggery. Like, yeah, but again, that misses the point, right? The point on making Flynn serve whatever time he gets in this case is about the rule of law. It's not about, you know, putting somebody who's dangerous behind bars. You know, I don't think he's dangerous. I think he just didn't care that he was breaking the law. And usually when you don't care if you break the law, like, and you get caught and you plead guilty, you got to do your time. So there you go.
Yeah. President Law and Order.
Yep.
Wouldn't you think that would be?
You would think.
Okay. This is what we have to look forward to with a bevy of Justins and Corys.
Yeah.
For 50 years. Don't even know how the law works.
It's,
and that's coming from someone who barely doesn't at all know what
that was. Again, you are more qualified than some of these Trump appointees. That absolutely.
This is depressing.
All right.
Well, we better
let's do something not depressing. Up.
Yeah. So for normies, of course, we're thanking our patrons. For patrons, that happens after T3BE. Just a reminder that we made that change. Hope you're enjoying it.
You're going to love this. Believe me, this is the greatest part of the program.
It's cool, just cool. Nice.
Thank you.
So, Andrew, why don't you start us off by thanking our new patrons at patreon.com/.
Yeah. So thank you to, I think, returning patron Guy Chapman, returning patron Rachel M, to Saul, to Jack Tway, to past the 13th century medieval Duchy of Saxony upon the left-hand side, I say. I think that's a past the Duchy reference, but that's excellent. David Lewis, thanks to Jim DV underscore S man. I have no idea what that means, but that's fabulous. And thanks for supporting us, Jim. And that's Jim with a J-Y-M, by the way. So I love that. Thanks to WWGZTD. What would G. Zachary Terwilliger do?
Well, he sucks. He's not a good, right? He's not any better than,
We're out of time. Chris Wilmoth, to excited to sit at the cool kids table. Yeah, you should be, because it's way cool and we love you more now that you're there. So, and thank you to Ben Jacobson, I think also returning patron. Thomas.
Awesome. Thank you to Forget the Pacific Northwest. Come do a live show in the Pacific Northeast, Korea.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Well, we're not doing any live shows, but someday. Ashley Hunnicutt, Michael Moriarty, Emily Antool, Amy Hensley, Justin Fabian, Molly Bowling, Bradford Keaty, Calder Cleveland, and Zach Watts. Thank you so much for pledging. And by the way, it is already just about the end of yet another month. I just am in disbelief at how fast time flies. But that means it's time for the Q&A, the monthly Q&A that we do on YouTube. It's a ton of fun. I think it's getting better every time. Everybody's allowed to come watch, interact somewhat. Of course, patrons are the only ones who get to ask the questions. That's still a patron perk, and that will be a Patreon thread. But that's going to be this Tuesday, June 30th we're going a little bit later than we normally do, but still not too terribly late. I think it should be fine for everybody. That's 5:30 PM Pacific, 8:30 PM Eastern or East Coast, whatever time. I always say the wrong thing. Then they're like, it's actually not that. Anyway, Eastern.
EDT, Eastern Daylight Time.
There you go. So that's going to be a ton of fun. Make sure you, you join us there and, ask the questions on Patreon and upvote the questions you like, all that good stuff.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
And now it is time for T3BE, and I just cannot get a question right. So let's see if I can.
All right. I got good feelings about this one, Thomas, but you know, sure I had good feelings about the last one. So,
and I blew.
Yeah. Well, you know, 7 years ago, a man, his sister and his cousin became equal owners as tenants in common of a house. Until a year ago, the man lived in the house alone. The sister and the cousin are longtime residents of another state. 1 year ago, the man moved to an apartment and rented the home to a tenant for 3 years under a lease that the man and the tenant both signed. The tenant has since paid the rent each month to the man. Recently, the sister and the cousin learned about this rental. They brought an appropriate action against the tenant to have the lease declared void and to have the tenant evicted. The tenant raised all available defenses. What will the court likely decide? A. The lease is void and the tenant is evicted. B, the lease is valid and the tenant retains exclusive occupancy rights for the balance of the term. C, the lease is valid, but the tenant is evicted because 1/3 of the lease term has expired and the man only had a 1/3 interest to transfer. Or D, the lease is valid and the tenant is not evicted, but must share possession with the sister and the cousin.
Wow. Okay, so this is interesting. So it seems like they're equal owners of a house as tenants in common, but only the one person lived in the house. The sister and the cousin live in another state. So then the guy says, I'm going to move to an apartment and I'm going to rent this house out to somebody under a lease. So it's kind of subletting, I guess. And then the tenant paid the rent each month. And so that's all working out, but then the sister and the cousin are like, hey, we didn't say you could do that or something. And they are bringing an appropriate action against the tenant to have the lease declared void. So this is interesting. There's some, so Before thinking, going into my extensive legal knowledge, I'll just talk about my my first impressions here. So on one hand, it seems like a one-third owner maybe doesn't necessarily have the right to just lease out the thing, like themselves. Like it makes sense that the other two owners could have a say in that. On the other hand, it also seems like you would want to protect the rights of a renter that doesn't have any idea about any of this, someone who like signed a lease, lives in a place, is making payments on time. So that could be a consideration there. I'm not sure what the law is going to say the right answer is. So let's go through the answer. A, the lease is void and the tenant is evicted. So that's a simple, that seems to, oh, and actually now that I look at it, that's the only void answer. So that would be, so if I think the lease should be void, that makes it a little easier. The answer is A, but that would be interesting as a test. You know, like it'd be interesting for the bar to do that because I imagine the harder thing would be to determine which of B, C, or D is the right valid, the lease is valid answer. So we'll see. Okay. B, the lease is valid and the tenant retains exclusive occupancy rights for the balance of the term. Huh. That's interesting. So that's really far off. That's like not only do you get to have this lease, also the tenant, because the only one that can occupy the house, like not even the cousin and the sister could do anything about it. That's curious. C, the lease is valid, but the tenant is evicted. What the? Because one third of the lease term has expired and the man only had a one third interest to transfer. That seems flat out bananas to me. I do not see how that could be the answer. It's like, well, since you own one third of this, you can rent this to somebody, but only for one third of the years that the lease agreement was. Like each person gets a year. Like the next year is the sister's term, and that if that is right, then truly the Justins and the Coreys have ruined our legal system because that makes no sense to me. So I'm eliminating D with prejudice, by the way. It's been a while since I've done that, but I'm eliminating C. Sorry, I think I said D. I'm eliminating C with prejudice. That answer is out of here, buddy. Get out of here. Okay, D. The lease is valid and the tenant is not evicted but must share possession with the sister and the cousin. So that's a real splitting the baby scenario, which, by the way, I know what the splitting the baby proverb is, and I'm making jokes about it for people who might write emails thinking I don't
have
actually
we, have
know
we really gotten emails off of us?
Here? Yeah, we got an email explaining that, and I was like, okay, it's I was making.
I mean, when we said everybody loves half a baby,
exactly, that was not real. So that's a real splitting the baby scenario. Like, yes, you have the lease, but also that's. I think this is this is the sitcom answer. This is the sitcom premise answer. D is sure the lease is valid, but you have to live with the sister and the cousin now, and of course they got to be terribly mismatched personality.
One has to be the butler for the.
Yeah, exactly. One's got to be really a partier, and the other's just all rules all the time, that kind of thing. So D is the sitcom answer. I don't know. Gosh, I don't really like that answer either. It really does kind of split it down the middle in terms of what happens. You can almost say like, well, that would be a good answer because that balances the concerns pretty well. But I don't know that the law would do that. I don't know. Something about it doesn't. Well, must share possession. What would it mean to share possession? I assume that just means that the tenant, that they could just come live there. Because like you don't really possess it in any other way but that. It's not as though the tenant is like an owner now, sharing possession. I don't like that answer. I'm just going to go with my instinct and say that is bad. So it's between A, the lease is void, which could be possible. Not a lot of explanation there. Or B, the lease is valid and the tenant retains exclusive occupancy rights for the balance of the term. Man, this is a tough one. Because I don't know that the law should want to say that if you are a part of a three-person ownership team of a thing, you could lease it without anyone else knowing, and then not only would the lease be valid, but the tenant would retain exclusive occupancy rights for the balance of the term. That seems tough to me. But what if it's like the finders keepers kind of law, squatter's rights, where it's like, well, if you didn't notice that, if you own a house and you didn't notice that someone else was living there for a year, then maybe they should be able to live there. Maybe that's where the law is going to go. You know, I'm going to hope that the law has some heart and compassion here. Because A, the lease is void and the tenant is evicted. It's possible. But I'm going to go with B, the lease is valid and the tenant retains exclusive occupancy rights for the balance of the term. That's my final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we will see you on Tuesday for, again, for normies. And now, caution, there's going to be some strong language in this Lamicus brief. But yeah, it'll be a lot of fun for patrons. A little bonus extra stuff for you. We'll see you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. And a big thank you to our Facebook moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Burr, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook, linked in the show notes. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.